And so now we have the Dragonfly Sutra Thread Q&A session. You want to say something, don't you, about the other questions on the Treehouse Forum?
Yes, the fact that I don't always read the forum doesn't mean that I ignore it. And I'm really happy for the opportunity to do these Q&A sessions because it does prompt me to go in and look at the forums, which I do at times, and what I miss is brought to my attention, and I'm continually impressed by the way that your questions demonstrate your intelligence and your mastery of this material of Gnosis and Sophianic animism. So that's always encouraging to me, and I want to thank you all for that.
Okay, Alexandra asked, why the Dragonfly Sutra? If I remember correctly, JLL said in the NAV briefings that when Sophia was going through a recapitulation, she reflected on why the previous experiments had gone wrong and realised that successful experiments require the ability to reflect. I'd add the ability to see from different perspectives and points of view in order for the experiment to continue, for evolution to happen, this is essential. I may be wrong, but I think the Dragonfly Sutra is medicine intended to help us restore this very crucial ability.
The Dragonfly Sutra is an event in the consciousness of the human species, a unique and novel event. Dragonfly Sutra is a tool for those who are willing to take it for what it is. Dragonfly Sutra is also an aspect of correction that applies in a particular way to Buddhists. I think I've made this point clear, and I want to make it really clear now speaking, that the Dragonfly Sutra is there for the benefit of anyone who wants to use it. But it has a particular bearing upon Buddhists. Now, there are a couple of legends in the received material of Buddhism that refer to the future of Buddhism. There are predictions.
The Dharma is over.
Yeah, there is a prediction that the Dharma will come to an end. That's attributed to Siddhartha himself. And by some accounts, it will come to an end 2,500 years after he lived. And if you calculate it, that's right now. So there is a prediction that the Dharma will come to an end. There is a prediction of the future Buddha called Maitreya. And there is also a prediction of an entity called Medicine Buddha. So there's a particular spin to this figure of Medicine Buddha that comes now, that emerges in the whole field of the field of participation in correction. There is an aspect that is addressed specifically to the Buddhists. So to make it simple, the Dragonfly Sutra is a medicine for Buddhists, but it's not a medicine for non-Buddhists because you don't need the medicine. Buddhists need a medicine to cure them of the pathology of Buddhism, which is degenerate, futile, self-contradictory, passé, and entirely non-productive and misleading. So the Dragonfly Sutra is there, and the Maitreya challenge, the teaching that comes along with it, is specifically directed toward Buddhists. And this is a very big deal, because in fact, there is no one giving Buddhists a dose of their own medicine. So the Dragonfly Sutra does that. But for those who are not Buddhists, it's not medicine. It is the jewel ornament of the terma of Gaia Awakening. It is what you enjoy to place on the throat of the wisdom goddess herself, like a decorated brooch or brooch, what do you call it? A decorated necklace. For the throat, and I emphasize, the throat of the wisdom goddess. So every time you recite the Dragonfly Sutra, it is as if you as a devotee of Sophia are placing this beautiful ornament upon her throat. That's what it is for you. It's an ornament to offer to the goddess. That's what it is for you.
To be fair, she did ask that question before you started writing about the Medicine Buddha.
Sure. I get that. And I haven't even begun to write about Medicine Buddha.
Okay, I asked the question to open the thread. How does Rigpa play into our dreams?
Something to be learned now that the Dragonfly Sutra is out. This is something to be learned. And it's a huge, huge learning. And it's a huge advantage to her in the way it helps her to coordinate with her witnesses. And I'm just seeing this myself. I'm just learning this myself, how this works. So I would say that for certain, I can say already, and this is just the first stage, we're a couple of months into it, that recitation of the Dragonfly Sutra and exposition, which means you discuss the things that it brings up when you're reciting it, it's all spontaneous. There's no doctrine involved. It's discussion, not doctrine.
Or dogma.
Or dogma. Although there is. It's the dogma in Dog Zen. Dogma. Well, the only dogma in Dog Zen is the dogma of the mother. And she doesn't have any dogma. Right? So anyway, good question. Doggone it, that's very brilliant of you to bring that up.
Barking.
Woof, woof. Barking, you're not barking mad, you're barking sane. Barking mad is a British expression, right?
Yeah.
Right. So to get back to the point, I am confident that profound and rapid changes in dream life occur once the Dragonfly Sutra is up and running. Well, I'm having them already.
We're having that. We've been discussing. Insight to my psyche, I've always had nightmares. Night sweats, nightmares. I wake myself up screaming or crying, and my dream life has completely changed in the last couple of months. I actually have dreams that I enjoy. I have a lot of lucid dreams.
Rigpa is certainly active in dreaming. But I'm not going to preempt myself by saying how. I'd rather learn a little more before I speak on it. But the one thing I can assure you is, a few things that I can assure you, that the way Rigpa works in dreaming is like rummaging through a junk heap. Okay? So I use the master analogy of going up into the attic with a flashlight. Keep going back to this master analogy. But that refers to the conscious operation of Rigpa. Why does Rigpa sometimes just flit among one thing or another? Dragonflies flit. The way they fly is a flitting flight.
But it's not random.
It's not random. They flit and they dart. You know? So why does Rigpa flit and dart over various things in an apparently random fashion, and then at other moments it appears to direct you in an intentional fashion?
Well, I think you can direct it as well.
That, of course, you can direct it. And one of the mysteries of Rigpa, one of the really astonishing features of it is, it's a factory installation that operates in a certain way, automatically. But at will, you can take over its operation.
This happens to me. I go out walking and I'll have random thoughts and then suddenly there's nothing. So I'll think, oh, okay, I'll recite the Dragonfly Sutra. And I do. And then I wait to see where Rigpa takes me. And very often it's not somewhere I want to go. No, don't want to think about that. But then something will come up that's worth my time of considering.
This is a basic practice, and it's fun. And by the way, Dog Zen is about making fun of enlightenment. Clear enough? Or piss take, as the British say, right? Taking the piss out of enlightenment, taking the piss out of Buddhism.
But it's also making enlightenment something palpable and real that you can grasp. It's not, you're not constantly grasping for the carrot on the stick, which is what Buddhism offers.
Indeed, and so the question arises is, well, what happens if this can really be turned around? In other words, 2,500 years of Buddhists have been grasping for the carrot. They've been grasping for the enlightenment. I've said before, the experience of enlightenment. Bring me somebody today who's attained enlightenment. I'd love to have a chat with them. I'd love to find them somewhere. I can't find them anywhere. The people who are speaking for Buddhism today, whether they be Western scholars like Alan Wallace, or whether they be Zenosh, of which there are many.
6 million.
Who have infiltrated Buddhism and who claim to speak for Buddhism, or whether they be lamas and rinpoches and gurus and swamis and mahatmas, I don't hear any of them speaking from the experience of enlightenment.
And you're looking every day. I hear you. You're always
I am listening because there's a lot of them on the internet. Yeah. I am listening. And I'm going to go hunt down the Dalai Lama if he comes to Europe next year. Anyway, the point is that it's not only making fun of enlightenment, but it's making enlightenment fun. And that's the only way that you can really have enlightenment now in Kali Yuga, as if it's fun to have it, and if you enjoy having it. And this is very enjoyable, what you just described. These simple tools, the zero reset, counting to one, watching what Rigpa does. And every time that you take command of Rigpa, you know, it's like cruise control in a vehicle. I don't know if they have that anymore. But they used to have this feature called cruise control. So you would go through first, second, third, and you would get into fourth or fifth gear, and you're driving down the highway, and then you click this button, and you're on cruise control.
And then you can speed up or slow down by your fingers.
That's
on the steering wheel. It's wonderful.
But essentially, it's like autopilot in an airplane. You know, when pilots fly you in an airplane from one place to another, they basically are on autopilot. But the pilot is there to take command of the airplane if necessary. This is the same thing with Rigpa. Rigpa operates on autopilot. And every one of us is familiar through countless millions of instances of the moment when you take Rigpa off autopilot and you take command of Rigpa. But how do you do that? How do you even know how to do that? How is that possible? It is a miraculous, delightful, baffling, enjoyable experience. And so the practice of Dog Zen simply enhances that enjoyment and gives you the opportunity to learn how Rigpa behaves when it's on autopilot and how it behaves when you are directing Rigpa yourself.
Okay, I'm going to read this comment as well because it came up in this same thread, and I'm trying really hard not to leave anyone out. John said, "It's one thing to wonder where the next thought comes from in our awakened state, but where then do the thoughts, dream subjects come from in the dream state, presumably from the same source?" So that's obviously when you're asleep, Rigpa's on autopilot.
Yes, it is. I only want to say a little bit about this now. I'm in the process of learning what Rigpa does when you sleep. And to go back to the beginning of this question, this is a question about how it behaves when you sleep.
It was me asking how Rigpa plays into your dreams.
Practice in Dog Zen totally and utterly changes your dream life. I can tell you.
Yeah, I agree.
And I'm just beginning to have that happen. I'd rather have some more experience on it before I comment further.
Great, and we can open another thread. Let's share what's going on, everybody. Before I go into the next question, I want to bring up, I think it's the appropriate time to bring up, something that we realised quite recently is learning the Dragonfly Sutra by rote doesn't work. So, you know, this is the miseducation system, isn't it? They set meaningless tests between people to divide and conquer, and those that are good at remembering and regurgitating, who can learn by rote, they're the people who are considered the clever people. They go on to become doctors, lawyers, vets, blah, 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 blah. So people who are having, tads who are having a problem reciting the Dragonfly Sutra because they just can't remember it,
are actually more receptive to how it works. This will come as a bitter pill to some people. For instance, those who listen to the recitation with Deva will say, well, how's it possible? You know, I can recite these four lines the first time I hear them, and here she is stumbling through them. If you can recite the first four lines the first time you hear them, then you have a problem.
Which leads me on to the next question from Ken. I played with the opening lines of the sutras today and was fascinated with it. Just like Deva, I stumbled every time, I went backwards. But after a while, I began to pick up the cadence. One step forward, two steps back. One step forward, three steps back, etc. I then began to think this is like breaking down the thought process to the binary level, one bit at a time. So I'm wondering if our thoughts actually occur in semblances to a single digital bit.
No, not at all. The miraculous function of the mind, which is a factory installation of the antipodes, is that it operates in a certain manner, and what we call IT, artificial intelligence, which is wrongly named because there is no artificial intelligence.
Information technology.
Right. I prefer to call it informational technology or archonic technology, archonic intelligence, but not artificial intelligence, because intelligence is living. It is alive. So why does the analogy of binary come up? This is a really important analogy. We can use it, but realize it comes up not because the genuine operations of the mind you have installed as a factory default installation is similar to archontic intelligence of machines. No. It's because you have the superior intelligence and the archontic intelligence simply copies it. And so the archontic intelligence is described as binary, and some people wrongly infer that the primary human intelligence which produced it must be binary. But that's not true. Binary is just a trope, but it's an extremely useful trope. Am I making sense?
Yes. Question from Zorba the Hun. Why do I keep waking up at 2:30 a.m. every night reciting the sutra? What the fuck? You evil Hun.
Yeah, really. Really. Dangerous, dangerous man. You're a dangerous man. Waking up in the middle of the night with a sublime tool of correction prompting you and prompting your intelligence. Eventually, you do get to the point where you're always awake. But this condition of being always awake is not what the Buddhists say it is. Nor does any Buddhist living today who might claim to have achieved that state, nor can any Buddhist living today, as far as I know, who claim to have achieved the state of awakeness, which is Buddhahood, can Fucking prove it. Prove it. It's the proof that matters. It's the demonstration of it that matters. And if you're standing there, sitting there on a platform, surrounded by beautiful bouquets with incense and people prostrating in front of you, and you are presumed to be in the awakened state, and all you're doing is regurgitating more Buddhist pap that has been
yana, yana, yana
for 25 centuries, then I don't buy that. And no one should buy that.
Next question, John again. Will the DFS also prove to be a lesson demonstration in and of poetic craft?
What?
Poetic craft.
Ah, poetic craft.
You know that course you teach on Nimitta?
That. Funny, my Rigpa has been going to that a lot lately. My Rigpa has been taking me to poetic craft. Well, yeah, listen. This is the bottom line. The only thing I can say about my enlightenment is that it's yours. How have I demonstrated my enlightenment? The same way that you will demonstrate yours. Everyone demonstrates their enlightenment in the same way, if it's genuine. There are many ways to demonstrate it in the finesse of how you live, in how you cook, in how you relate to animals, in how you take a walk, in how you row a boat, many, many ways. But the fundamental way is that you show originality. And as I said in the introduction to the poetic craft talk, the value of poetry is that it shows you what is genuine and original in what you know and what you say. There's only one reason for studying poetry, and that is to hone your sensibility to that originality. Originality is the proof of enlightenment. If you cannot say anything original, you're not enlightened. You're not able to demonstrate and enjoy the enlightenment that you already have. That is how you enjoy it, by being original and funny.
So this is another thing that comes up from another thread that Ben has written. He's been recording his synchronistic fugues that he's had with your work. Now, I suspect that Ben is ahead of the curve. Almost sat in front of your broomstick with you, I would say. He showed a picture of his door where... So Ben's a craftsman. He does these amazing sculptures that he shared. And there's a door that he calls, it's your arm wielding a sword. And he put a dragonfly knocker on the door and kind of forgot about it. And he was clearing the snow from the door the other day and saw the dragonfly knocker. So he had this realisation, right, which I think is brilliant, so I'd like you to talk about it. He says, so much of this battle consists of being able to mentally handle the astounding and challenging information put in front of us and the ability to calm the mind and understand what is happening to us easily, seen as an invaluable tool or weapon. So he's talking about the Dragonfly Sutra.
When I hear that comment, my Rigpa goes to something that I know. I think it comes out of the philosophy of the Spartans of ancient Greece, who were very formidable warriors. It may or may not, but it comes out of classical humanistic European culture and antiquity, and it's a trope that many people have heard, a meme, which is sound mind in a sound body. So to be a warrior, you have to have a sound body, you have to be strong, you have to be in good shape, and of course self-care is an issue that we discuss now and then regarding PT, self-care, self-love. The Dragonfly Sutra is about being of sound mind. There's too much coming at us for any of us to handle. And so what do? As warriors, well, cultivate the sound mind, cultivate the sanity of mind. The Dragonfly Sutra is a tool for doing that. And as you do that, and your mind becomes sound and sane, you become more competent as a warrior to handle whatever the challenges may be at any particular moment. So yeah, I would say it is more than an accessory. It is a complement to the path of the warrior, definitely.
And to the path of eugenics. If everything happens in the psyche, all disease happen in the psyche, then when you have a biological conflict or a sudden shock that you weren't expecting, and then you end up getting sick because of that, if your mind is healthy, the recovery process is going to be a lot shorter.
Indeed, the mind is overwhelmed by all of the challenges to sanity that confront us all every day. And honing the mind, just the practice of honing the mind, which is this practice of Dog Zen, has such beneficial results. First of all, it allows you to select your battles more carefully. See, the problem is that the mind can't sort out all the problems that have been imposed upon the mind by the adversaries of life. And they know that. And they count on you being mentally overwhelmed. And so, by sharpening your mind, you can cut through that assault of insanity. And also, by sharpening your mind, I'm beginning to see now that you've become more able to laugh a lot of it off. And we have to laugh it off. We have to laugh a lot of it off.
So the Dragonfly Sutra is the antidote to too many black pill days.
Too many, many black pill days, indeed.
Cool. Okay, we've got three more questions left. Zorba the Hun wants to know if this holds up. So he's doing the counting of the Dragonfly Sutra. First attention, 0. Mm-hmm. Second attention, 1. Third attention, 1.1.
Well, I don't know. It could. You know, we're all those who take on this practice are building it together. You could build it in that way. It so happens that your question raises an issue which I've been contemplating all day today prior to this conversation, and I didn't know it would be relevant to this conversation until you brought it up. The first, second, and third attention are subjects, practices, that can be really sharpened with the Dragonfly Sutra. It goes back to the primary mantra of 1 banana, 2 banana, 3 bananas. So 1 banana is the first attention, which is your attention to the material world immediately present. 2 banana is your attention to your dreaming. That's where that comes in. And 3 banana is the attention that you have in amplification of power, knowing that you are present in her dreaming, the third attention. So I would say that right now, it would be better, I'm intrigued by this analogy, 0, 1, 1.1. But for right now, I would just let it float. And there's more instruction coming about how the three attentions can be optimized through the Dragonfly Sutra.
Okay, next question. relating to the Dragonfly Sutra from Deborah, do other animals have mind? She says, my feeling is no, and I'm specifically thinking about dogs here. I am basing this opinion on having studied with dog trainer and philosopher Kevin Behan. Kevin contends that dogs do not have a mind, as they do not have a concept of self as separate from the environment. He believes that dogs operate on feelings and emotions instead of mind. What does the main professor think about this? Is the mind, as an installation of the aeons, purely a tool for the anthropos?
Well, the self-reflective mind that is a factory installation of the human animal certainly is unique to the human animal. But don't rule out the existence of a non-self-reflective mind. You know, the only reason why you even have a self-reflective mind is because your mind can form the concept of an ego. I think it's pretty clear, and I think that many people would agree, that animals do not have a self-reflective capacity to form the concept of an ego. That certainly doesn't mean that they lack mind.
Okay, that's reminding me of a conversation we had recently about, you said, come on, I've told you that animals fall into one or two categories. They're either narcissists or they're codependent.
Human animals are either narcissists or codependents.
And then we talked about four-legged animals. Cats are narcissists, of course, right. And dogs are codependent.
That's right.
But actually what you've just said there, so it's not really about whether dogs have mind or not, it's about the ego. So they could still have mind, but they don't have the ego that humans have.
No, they don't. They're blessedly free of the ego mind that you have, which causes you to identify yourself uniquely as human. That's a delusion. What causes you, what genuinely makes you human, is the intelligence that you have, the intelligence of the anthropos, which can be described in Gnostic terms according to the calibration of the anthropine plasm. So there are seven capacities. The calibration gives you seven capacities of intelligence. Now, animals have, first of all, another kind of intelligence, which is in certain ways superior to ours. And secondly, they have another kind of mind. And their mind is free of the tendency as well as the ability to form an ego concept. You know, you don't have an ego, you just have a fucking ego concept. It's just something to wake up to. But nevertheless, that ego concept is a significant production of your mind. You have to learn how to use it properly. It's very odd, and you'll all get a laugh out of this, I think, that I pointed out to Kerdwin the other day, that the Tibetan word for ego
yid.
Is yid. I fucking kid you not. It's Y-I-D, yid. So we got yid, whether you like it or not, and you better make the best of it. And not the worst of it, right? So this is a serious question, and I want to go back and respond to it just for a moment from a different angle. First of all, animals have a group soul, to use the old term, that actually goes back to Germanic nature mysticism.
Different soul field to humans, then.
Yeah, they have a different kind of morphogenetic soul field, in which the individual animal, like the dog of the canine morphogenetic field, or the owl of the, what's the word for birds?
Avine,
morphogenetic field of owls, you know, has an intelligence that is a group intelligence. How can birds fly in those fantastic formations of murmuration? You never see one of them fly into another, and they never knock each other out of the sky. But look at humans in a crowd. Humans are always knocking each other out of the way. We have a huge boundary problem. don't we?
Ego.
Yeah, which is due to ego. So don't confuse the fact that you have the privilege of a factory installation of a mind that allows you to conceive of ego.
Privilege? It's a fucking disability, isn't it?
It is a privilege and a disability. But don't confuse the fact that you can form the concept of an ego in your mind with the fact of having an ego. Now, it's very clear. One of the things that comes up for me when I think about this question is, in the mind of the questioner, what's going on in your mind? Now, you're a human animal. You would agree with that Gnostic definition, I'm sure. And as a human animal, you have mind. You have this property, which we're now beginning to investigate and beginning to learn in Dogzen, that when you enjoy learning how it works, that is liberation. That is enlightening. There is no enlightenment, some final state that you reach. There is only enlightening.
Enlightenment.
Yeah, there's only enlightening. There's no enlightenment. You know. So as you enjoy this enlightening regarding your own mind, and you look at other human animals around you, and you look at them and you nod, and you know, oh, they have the same mind as I do. But then you look at a cat or a mouse or a gerbil or a horse or an elephant or a dog, and you know that they don't have the same mind, but are you going to say that they don't have any mind at all? That would be a huge mistake.
So would you agree, I postulated that animals, non-human animals, get installed with the mind that they require for their
group soul activity. That's right. And at the same time, it doesn't stop there. The mind of a dog or the mind of a cat can be entrained by the mind of the human animal that it is bonded with. And so, even though they don't have a mind, non-human animals don't have a mind that can form a self-reflective ego, they do have a mind that is interactive with other minds. And you and I and no human animal can even begin to grasp the dimension of their minds. The way they interact with each other, the way that they talk to each other, the way that they communicate, all the animals in nature, and I mean snakes, insects, everything you can mention, they also have a kind of mind.
And plants.
They also have a kind of mind. They have certainly intelligence, because all that lives in her body, in her dream body, shares a tremendous richness of intelligence. No one would argue about that. Every life form is intelligent. Additionally, there is a mystery to be explored. If you don't preclude on the basis of human arrogance and egotism that animals don't have a mind, if you don't exclude it, there's a mystery to be explored. Well, what kind of mind do they have? And how is it different from ours? And here's the beauty of it. How does it interact with ours? So certainly, if your cat is sitting there on the table, your cat is not having the same reflections that you have in your mind as a human animal.
I don't think they have monkey mind.
Well, goddess bless them. They are so lucky.
Mm.
Cats are kind of Rigpa, aren't they? I mean, I think cats are Rigpa. Cats are a furry Rigpa.
Purry Rigpa.
A purry and a furry Rigpa. But really, it's a fascinating vein of exploration. And my final word would be respect. Respect animals for the mind that they do have, even though you, in your human mind, cannot equate it with your human mind.
Would you like to add a note about animal communication?
Well, I think that animal communication is part of correction. It's a big part of correction. It's going to come up again and again. And we're not going to get through the experience of correction without correcting our relations to the three yanas of animals.
Nikita's instruction.
Right.
Okay, next.
Those are the yanas that count, you know. You can just ignore the yana, yana, yana of the Buddhists who are just going on like a broken record, repeating the doctrine. But the yana of domestic animals, that's the little yana. The yana of
subsistence
animals like cows, animals that we rely on for food and other purposes, is the middle yana. And the yana of wild, untamed animals is the highest yana. Those are the three yanas that matter in correction. And so the question of the mind of animals is one that we leave open, and we respect the opportunity to learn more about it.
Next question is from Guyan Thrill. I love this question. Is the Booth side of the Ainit Mother in her non-material immanence under the veil of manifestation, or is it the Pleroma? Even, is it necessary to hold distinction between the two, Sapphira and the Pleroma, now that she has recovered her agency? Is there a distinction to hold between Sapphira and Rigpa?
Well, I won't comment on Sapphira and Rigpa right now, but I will comment on the previous question. There is a distinction between the aeons in the Pleroma and Sapphira, and you already know what that is. They are similar in that they all use the same method or mechanism of cosmic projection to produce worlds. They are different in that the aeons themselves are not routinely present in the worlds that they produce, as she is. So she is present Booth side and theater side.
Both.
That's not normally the case, if you can speak of any kind of normalcy. But we have to establish some kind of norm. Otherwise, we're never going to work out. We're never going to be able to get our minds around how this immense proposition works. And that is a simple and reliable distinction. She is both theater side, Booth side, because she produces the world projection. And she is theater side because she is in the world projection with us.
Okay, then going through, added, it was a little video of Bruce Lipton wearing a wig, looking very strange. Bruce Lipton says that the cell's membrane is a computer chip. So going through's question is, what are the signals that the Dragonfly Sutra sends to our cells?
Well, first of all, Bruce Lipton is a dubious character.
Zenos alert.
And problem is, you see, it's always the same problem with the Zenosh. They prey upon the natural genius of the Rome and of the Anthropos.
I think he was a good one.
Absolutely.
I'm not going to condemn him. No.
But I will say this. I'll try to put this concisely. It's all about epigenesis. And he is one of the leading people who's teaching epigenesis. Okay, fine. If his teaching is genuine, if it's valid, verifiable, great. All gratitude to Bruce Lipton for that. However, my sense is that the knowledge of epigenesis that we can have as Gnostics is superior to anything that he is teaching. So I'm a little bit wary about certain things that are coming through Bruce Lipton. For instance, he talks about something called the imaginal cell. Now, this is an extremely interesting concept. Again, I think there are things to be learned here, but at the same time, don't ever give anyone else more credit than you give yourself for what you can learn. So what was the last part of that question? signals.
What are the signals that the Dragonfly Sutra sends to ourselves?
To ourselves? C-E-L-L-S. Signals. Well, basically, it sends the message that enlightenment is something to be enjoyed. Dog Zen doesn't just make fun of enlightenment. It makes enlightenment fun. Making enlightenment fun is the way to approach it in correction. Now, fun, amusement, delight, humor, comedy, Jupiter, this is all Jupiter, Thelete, the guru, fun is a kind of a signal. Everyone knows when you want to have fun. Everyone knows when
when you're having fun.
And you know when you're having fun because you're firing certain neurons. So, yeah, I would say that the Dragonfly Sutra does induce the firing of certain neurons. I would say that it induces serotonin. And when you have more serotonin streaming across your synapses, then you're having more fun.